As a company, we've been really focused on the entire continuum of cancer. We started with advanced cancer, and we went in advanced cancer because that was where the biggest patient need was. The time to treatment was critical, decision-making was critical, it was guidance that we needed to provide to doctors. In fact, many a times I say our test acts as a GPS for the doctor to be able to make a treatment decision for the patient. But more importantly was, as you have mentioned, in the early detection, we wanted to be able to bend mortality curves. That was the whole reason why we got into fighting cancer in the first place. The only way you're going to be able to do it is to, if you are able to detect it early. Then you are not treating disease, you are actually being able to cure disease, right? If you're stamping it out.
Welcome to Health Tech Central, the podcast that connects you with the wisdom of trailblazers at the intersection of health, care and technology. 42-ish minutes of entertaining inspiration, actionable insights, and answers to just about everything. Hitchhiking most definitely allowed. With your host, Mehdi Khaled.
Hi, everyone. He's the CEO of Guardant Health, Asia, Middle East, and Africa, a precision oncology company based in Singapore and specializing in genomic profiling and liquid biopsies. He's got 18 years of senior management experience in Asia-Pacific healthcare sector. And he held previous roles at IQVIA, as well as a chairman of BioSingapore, an industry association of life sciences businesses. He's got an academic background in biomedical sciences for the National University of Singapore and in strategy from the University of Chicago. He's a member of the Oversight Committee for Singapore's National Health Innovation Center and an evaluator of the Diagnostics Development Hub under the Agency for Sciences, Technology and Research, otherwise known as ASTAR in Singapore. He's led Guardant Health EMEA to expand its presence to 41 countries across Asia, the Middle East and Africa, and he's recognized with awards including the 2020 Singapore Business Review Healthcare Team of the Year and CEO of the Year. There are more awards that are coming we're going to talk about, very exciting. Want to welcome Simranjit Singh. Hi, Simran. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi, Mehdi. Good to be on the show as well.
How are you? How have you been, man? Long time.
I've been good. I mean, it's been considerably long time. I mean, I think you were based in Singapore in the 2000s, I think, and we first met. So 2010 was the first time that we interacted, if you remember, on a panel for Hospital Asia. That's a long time ago.
It was a very long time ago. Well, very happy to reconnect and very excited to see you've been very successful on your journey. As a chief executive officer of Guardant Health, you've overseen the expansion into 41 or 40 plus countries in a very short period of time, I have to say. It's really impressive. I wanted to ask you about what were the most significant cultural and regulatory challenges in actually bringing something that is fringe medical diagnostics, that is precision oncology, to such diverse markets?
Right. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think in terms of healthcare, we are the second most regulated industry after aviation. So mm-hmm. There's a lot that needs to be considered as you are bringing product to market, right? One is obviously whether you have the right product market fit, whether there's a need in the market, whether are you really making a substantial difference in terms of treatment outcomes or in terms of diagnostic value for the patient. And so there's a lot of consideration that go into understanding really is there a patient need that you're addressing. So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is that in many of the markets in precision oncology or precision medicine, the entire regulations are still being developed in Asia specifically, right? So in the US, you have a more developed and more established pathway where you have NGS IVD, next generation sequencing IVD pathway. But outside of the US, that interpretation is actually, it's very different, right? And I give you an example. Our approval in Japan is a medical device software. It's not IVD. In Europe, it's IVDR. So it's traditional in vitro diagnostics, not even NGS IVD. In Singapore, it's a hybrid of medical device software and IVD together. And so it's one that is really nuanced based on the country and based on how they are interpreting or understanding the, this new technology, right? We are in the intersection of medical device, IVD, and software. And so because of that, the fact that we are in that intersection, they can interpret it differently. And so that proposes a lot of burden on us, because we will have to redesign our entire dossier based on their interpretation. So you can't take your dossier, lift and shift from what you have in FDA to put it into Japan. And you can't do the same for Japan to Singapore or other jurisdictions. So this is something that, you know, we have worked on and have now been able to perfect it because of the fact that we worked very closely with the regulators. We've been able to educate them that, hey, this is the new technology. This is how the technology works. This is how it's a confluence of different technologies that come together to be able to determine this test. We have biochemistry. We have next generation sequencing. We have bioinformatics. We have machine learning. All of that coming together into our product and our technology. And so the ability for them to understand all of it is one that requires us to be able to provide them with the adequate information and take the time to be able to bring them across to have a deeper understanding of the technology. And so that's what we have done. And, you know, we've been fairly successful in doing that as well. We got our first FDA approval in 2020 for liquid biopsy. So we've been the pioneers of that. We got our first approval for NGS testing here in Singapore. So we are, in fact, till today, we are the only company that has HSA approval. We were the first to get IVDR approval in Europe. And we also have medical device software approval in Japan. So been fairly successful to doing that. But the struggles that we had was quite considerable, right? Because we had to really educate and bring the regulators with us.
In terms of documenting all that process, can other companies like you, you were a startup, obviously, and you really reinvented the wheel because the process was not there. So you have, at the same time as you were flying the plane, you had to design it. And so is there anything documented that can help other organizations or other startups to take the same path and not having to start counting from zero again?
I think we have sort of blazed the trail for them, because now that we have had and we have set the precedence, because we have been able to get our approvals, they now have at least a template of how they can get to the, or at least a pathway of how they can get to approvals, right? So we have seen many of them, many other companies try to emulate us or try to follow our footsteps in terms of the, of regulatory approvals. But it is difficult because it's not only about following the pathway, Matt. It's also about the ability to get analytical validation and clinical validation done. So it's not just that there is a process that you need to be able to follow and the steps you need to take to get to regulatory approval. You must have the basic fundamental of clinical validation and analytical validation already completed, right? They must be at a threshold of sensitivity and specificity in your analytical validation and your clinical trials that are able to back you up that in the real world setting, your product is going to work, right? And so I think that's where we have been able to differentiate ourselves from a lot of competitors, because till today, there are only two products that have got FDA approval in liquid biopsies, right? And we were the first to get it. And many others have tried, but have still not been able to get to that bar that is being looked at by, or the threshold that is being looked at by the regulators for clinical validation and analytical validation for them to.
The term liquid biopsy stems from the fact that you detect circulating tumoral DNA in the circulating blood. That's what liquid biopsy is. So instead of going into the tumor and doing an in vivo biopsy, you actually detect the DNA, the circulating DNA of that particular tumor in the blood. And so,
yes.
And this has gained traction right after COVID, I would say. How do you see this reshaping the cancer treatments and cancer diagnostics in Asia? The reason why I say Asia is because, as you know, Simran, more than half of the deaths in Asia, and it's a big population, billions, right? We're talking about 3 billion people, are caused by cancer. And so you have a big population, you have a big incidence and prevalence of diseases that are cancers. and you have a very ripe territory for the type of diagnostics that you bring into the table. So how do you see this evolving and shaping the cancer diagnostics in Asia?
You're absolutely right. If you look at that cancer prevalence and cancer mortality, the most number of new cases of cancer, more than 50% of them are in Asia. But if you look at mortality, more than 60% of mortality is in Asia. So you're seeing that there's a disproportionate amount of people that are being impacted, or the burden of disease is much higher. And obviously, it is based on diagnosis. It's also based on treatment options. It's also based on quality of care and access to care. So all of that play a part in terms of the cancer burden. But from our perspective, you know, rightly mentioned, COVID changed a lot of perspectives on diagnostics as a whole, right? There, a lot of people did not understand or did not appreciate the value of diagnostics until COVID hit. And it became a means of that, hey, if you're not being able to at least have effective diagnostics, how are you going to be able to even treat effectively? Right? That paradigm shifted because of COVID, because the understanding deepened that diagnostics is just as important as the treatment decisions that you are making based on the diagnostics. So that helped us. The other thing that helped us during COVID was the fact that many of the elective surgeries were sort of abandoned, right? Were not able to proceed because patients were not allowed to come into hospitals for elective surgeries. And many a time, tissue biopsies are considered as elective surgeries. And so in many markets or many countries, many of the cancer patients were not able to come in to be able to get tissue biopsies done, and hence could not start treatment because there was no tissue sample that was collected for genomic profiling for them, right? And so that created a big gap in terms of how can we start treatment for patients. Patients are being delayed in terms of their treatment, and in advanced cancer patient, time to treatment is absolutely critical. It is life and death. And so what we saw, Madhin, during the COVID period was we had webinars where we were talking to oncologists. We had close to about 600 to 700 oncologists come onto our webinars to understand more about liquid biopsies. They were so interested because they were able to now start treatment based on a blood test, and a blood test that can be performed at home. So we sent phlebotomists to the home of patients, collect a blood sample, send that up for genomic profiling, and then they can start treatment for their patient because they don't have to come in for elective biopsy. So it sort of changed the paradigm. Many countries then were more open towards liquid biopsies. We actually gained a lot of traction and a lot of experience from oncologists that went through this period with us and then saw that, hey, you know, liquid biopsies are just as effective, and in certain instances or certain cancers, even more effective than tissue biopsies. And that sort of created an inflection point for us. So yes, one is COVID helped from the diagnostics standpoint, but it also was a direct help for us, for oncologists to experience a liquid biopsy.
There are many types of cancers, right? And obviously the testing differs because types of cancer will dictate a different methodology and approach to detect that particular cancer. Some of the diagnostics that you've recently come up with, and it's been, I guess, nominated on the list of Time Best Inventions for 2024, just recently, actually, on the 30th of October, I've just seen. I'm really rooting for you to get it, and hopefully you will. How does that compare to the already existing array of diagnostics methods? That's, for example, a so-called occult blood test that is also non-invasive based on the collection of fecal material and sending it to the lab. How does that tie with that particular diagnostics method?
Sure. No, thanks, Mehdi, for the shout out as well. As a company, we've been really focused on the entire continuum of cancer. We started with advanced cancer, and we went in advanced cancer because that was where the biggest patient need was. The time to treatment was critical. Decision-making was critical. It was guidance that we needed to provide to doctors. In fact, many a times I say our test acts as a GPS for the doctor to be able to make a treatment decision for the patient, right? And so we started in advanced cancer. We have moved from advanced cancer to recurrence monitoring, so earlier stage of cancer. many times patients in stage 2, stage 3 cancers go through a surgical resection. The surgeon takes away the tumor, and the biggest anxiety is whether the tumor margins have all been taken or not. And is the cancer going to come back? Is there a risk for recurrence? And so now we have a test in that setting for recurrence monitoring. So 2 to 4 weeks after the surgery, the doctor is able to prescribe a test to see whether there's still circulating tumor DNA. And if there is, then there's a high prognostic value that that person will have a recurrence of cancer and so should be put on some sort of low-dose chemotherapy or certain regimen that would be preventative in nature. So there's a need for that. It helps in taking an escalating decision on treatment and also helps in a de-escalating, right? So if there is no tumor DNA detected, then there might be a shorter period of chemotherapy that is prescribed instead of a 12-month period, a 6-month period. Right.
So you're basically cutting off the guesswork of oncologists post-surgery by providing empirical evidence about whether or there is or there is no risk of recurrence based on the detection of circulating tumoral DNA.
Correct. So we are doing it at a molecular level. And many a times this progression occurs or the high risk occurs before it is also seen radiologically. So it happens before it's obvious on a CT scan or an MRI. And so this helps in terms of providing the treatment decision much earlier, right? Because the doctor has to make that decision before he can see it on the scan. And so this way it helps them to sort of see whether this is a high-risk patient or a lower risk patient. But more importantly was, as you have mentioned, in the early detection, we wanted to be able to bend mortality curves. That was the whole reason why we got into fighting cancer in the first place. The only way you're going to be able to do it is if you are able to detect it early. Then you are not treating disease, you are actually being able to cure disease, right? If you're stamping it out before it becomes a full-blown cancer, then your chances of success and curative intent is much higher, right? So when we looked at that, we started our focus on colorectal cancer first. So that's the test that has been nominated on time, Guardant Shield. So we were the first company to get FDA approval for this blood test in colorectal cancer. We did a large scale study called the Eclipse study, right? And we were able to get 83% sensitivity and 90% specificity of the test, right? So that's really high in terms of threshold of the test. And then you asked, how does this differ from a fecal occult test, right? And so it's very interesting. Fecal occult test has been here for FIT test has been around for many years, many, many years. And the problem is that the compliance rate for testing is so low. I give you an example. In Singapore has the lowest colorectal cancer compliance rate. Take a guess. How low is the compliance rate in Singapore?
I'm shocked already. Tell me.
You know how compliant Singapore is in terms of health screening.
That's why I'm shocked.
And the compliance rate in Singapore is 27%.
For one third.
Colorectal
cancer
screening.
Less than one third.
Right?
Wow.
So there are only two modalities that are offered. It's either a fecal occult test or FIT test, or it's a colonoscopy.
Colonoscopy,
right?
Which is heavier.
Those are the two. Yeah. Those two that are offered. And many, many, many Singaporeans, male and female, in fact, female worse than male, don't do either of these tests. And the reason is very simple. For a colonoscopy, you need to be able to do a prep the day before, right? You're basically going to be sitting next to the washroom.
Yes.
Then you've got to go and do an invasive procedure, and then you have another day of recovery. So 3 days, and it's fairly costly procedure, right? So typically, anywhere between $2,000 to $2,500. So that's the cost for a colonoscopy and the inconvenience that you have. For fecal tests, it's literally free. When you reach 45 years and above, the government of Singapore sends you a fecal occult test in your mail that you should be sending it to your primary care physician as quickly as you can and get that done. Nobody does it because of the inconvenience factor. When you go through a health screening, people cannot on demand. You can't go and get a fecal test done immediately. You have to go back home, come back the next day and give it. The other thing is that there's a factor.
And you have to do it 3 days in a row if you want to do it right. That's the thing. You have to do it 3 days in a row. So it's very, it's less invasive, but still inconvenient, right?
Yes, exactly. Because the sensitivity is not very high. So you, in order to increase sensitivity, you need to be able to do it a couple of times so that it's confirmatory. So this is another reason why then the inconvenience factor becomes much, much higher. And so people then look at it and they say, oh, I don't have any symptoms. I'm not having any blood in my stool. I'm not having any bloatedness, no stomach pain or issue. Why should I do it? So they ignore it. But for a blood test, they are already providing their blood sample for every single other biometric biomarker that they're looking at for health screening. So it's not inconvenient to provide another tube of blood for a screening test. So that's the reason why we are seeing the traction of adoption, because we have taken away the inconvenience factor. We have made it something that is value add and is easy to do.
So for the anecdote, I have a good friend, the GI gastroenterology doctor in Belgium. It was many years ago. When Brad Pitt turned 50, he sent him an occult blood test anonymously to the US just to start screening. And the guy actually posted it on his social media website saying, this Belgian doctor sent me this kit. It was very funny. So, but to your point, I think you're hitting the mark here when you're saying we're doing it in a very highly cost-effective, non-invasive, high-sensitivity, high-specificity way. That's another standard, and really, really big congratulations for that. That's a big milestone. Now, in terms of, this is at the patient level. I'd be more interested in having it at population level, population screening level. You know, some populations have more propensity to develop colon cancers than others. Basically, the more meat eater you are, and there are other factors as well that play a role, the more unlucky you are to develop colon cancer.
Yeah.
How does it work at population level in terms of population screening? Have you gotten to that level yet? Or are you thinking about it?
That's a good point. So that's where we are working more and more, and we are trying to collaborate more and more with governments. You know, Betty, that's where we can't do it on our own, right? It has to be part of some sort of national screening project, national screening program that we are looking at being able to roll it out to different groups. There are also a lot more populations that are like familial adenoma polyps, FAP group. There are familial hereditary predispositions to colon cancer as well.
That's what we call the at-risk population.
Absolutely. So it's got to be looking at risk. It has to be looking at the entire population level, where you're not only looking at 45 and above or 50 and above. You're looking at early onset of colorectal cancer that's in the South Asian population and in the Middle Eastern population. This is becoming a big thing where there's an early onset of colorectal cancer and fairly aggressive colorectal cancer. So these are pockets where we have to work with governments to be able to provide those programs, right? Because taking an investment or taking that from a company level is much harder to do. And to be able to do this effectively, you need traction on a national level.
And then you can start actually showing the numbers, because when you do it at population levels, you are able to scale and you are able to show the value of that, because colorectal cancer, especially in cultural settings such as the Middle East, it's still very taboo to talk about blood in your stool. And it's still very,
Absolutely.
You know, people get very late. And when they get to the doctor, actually, most times the cancer has spread out. It's very late stage. And I think the earlier you get, the more scale at population level you have, the more adoption of that particular diagnostic procedure at population level.
That's when you truly see the bending of the mortality curves, right? When you are able to go in and detect cancer early. Ultimately, they will still need to go through a colonoscopy for a curative procedure, right? You have to remove the polyp, right? But the fact is that if you have not highlighted to them that there is a specific issue and they are not testing for it regularly, then you will never be able to get to that level of detection and that level of curative intent.
Yeah. Let's take a stab at another topic, which is adjacent to this one, because you've worked extensively in healthcare across Asia Pacific. How do you see the landscape of precision medicine evolving differently in the region compared to Western markets?
I mean, I've had a front row seat in terms of how regulators, policymakers have started to think about precision medicine, right? I think precision oncology is probably one of the earliest use cases where you have seen diagnostics, you have seen treatments, whether they're targeted therapy or immunotherapy, all focus on specific biomarkers. So it's very much to its true form, precision medicine. And so that's where many of them have sort of looked at it in different ways. We've seen advanced markets like for example Japan come up very very quickly to look at adoption of genomic profiling, right? They're one of the earliest to come up with a regulatory pathway for comprehensive genomic profiling, whether it's for tissue or whether it's for liquid. They've also then started looking at how do they create cancer control programs nationally based on this genomic profiling test that they're doing. They created, in fact, a national platform called the Scrum Initiative. So they looked at the top three cancers in the country: lung cancer, colorectal cancer, and gastric cancer, right? And they said, okay, every single advanced cancer patient in the country that has any of these three top cancers should be able to get comprehensive genomic profiling done for them. And that will then be, after which they will be able to be put into a basket clinical trial or basket clinical study where they will either get standard of care therapy or they will work with biopharma for new therapies. So they will get enrolled into, based on their biomarker or the mutations that are driving their cancer, alteration that's driving their cancer, they get into different study arms. So they created an entire public-private partnership, 19 biopharma companies, the government, and 260 hospitals across Japan. And basically, everybody gets standard of care therapy or gets enrolled into these new treatments or new drugs. And they've been able to accelerate drug development. They've been able to provide the patients with genomic profiling. They've been able to now create an entire pathway for regulatory expedited pathway for review for new therapies as well. So this is one way, I think, from a national standpoint where you create a win-win-win situation, win for the patient, win for the doctors, win for biopharma companies as well.
I'm pleasantly surprised because knowing Japan very well, it's typically slow. The process of adoption and regulation is very, very slow. But I'm pleasantly surprised to see this path being accelerated through the regulators in Japan. And as know the Japanese people and the culture, I guess the adoption rate of being on a clinical trial here or there would be like more than 100% because they're very altruistic in nature. It's, let's do it, man. That's great.
Yes. So you're absolutely right, Mehdi. I was also surprised about this when we were putting this together with the different agencies there, right? The government agencies as well as the hospitals. In fact, they've gone even further. They even have classified 200 hospitals as core genomic hospitals. So if you want to get comprehensive genomic profiling done, these core genomic hospitals will be able to provide that for you as a patient, right? So they've actually paved the way and have created a model that other countries are now following. And now we're seeing Korea follow a very similar concept. We are seeing Singapore follow a very similar concept.
Yes, I was about to say
so
that.
So it's one thing that has helped, that has bridged that gap, right? It's always a problem on biopharma companies willing to invest in new therapies. That investment in new therapies and clinical trials will drive greater adoption in the country in the first place, right? When you talk about diagnostics. So it's all interlinked. And to create a model that works like this helps overall for the country perspective.
And from an economic standpoint, it is a lot less costly to do early diagnostics as opposed to treat cancer patients. We know cancer patients are very, very costly in the treatments and chemotherapies.
Yes.
And the cost of care is horrendous. And so by investing a little bit It's like a kite effect, right? You move the handlebar by 1 centimeter and the kite moves like 150 meters on the other side, right? And so that's the same effect here because it scales very quickly because when you see, as we said, when you see the impact at population level and bending the curve, then people will understand because statistics don't lie.
Yes.
Good statistics, right? So you can fry the numbers, but then when the numbers make sense and the methodology is right, then you can see the value and the impact of that.
The only problem there, Mehdi, I mean, it's easier to do in the advanced cancer setting than it is in the early detection setting. And the reason is twofold. One is in the early detection setting, you have to still fight mindset of people,
yep.
the population, right? And here you're not talking about patients, you're talking about healthy individuals who have a mindset that cancer is never going to happen to them, right? And so that mindset shift takes a lot of time and a lot of investment, right? It's not you have to create marketing programs, promotion campaigns. You have to create a lot of push factors so that they actually go and actually screen. So it's not that easy, right? And conceptually it's great, and you're right, but from an execution standpoint, it's not that easy. Then the second part of it is that in the past, you had a lot more cancer that was undiagnosed. If you don't have a definitive diagnostic journey, if you are going to be diagnosing cancer early, in certain cancers, what are you going to do next? There is no definitive next step. So you create anxiety. So it's very important to look at that diagnostic journey. So that's one of the reasons why we focus on colorectal cancer, because we knew that you get a positive, the next step is a colonoscopy and there's curative, is a curative procedure. In certain cancers, there's no next step, and then you're sitting with the anxiety of that cancer. It's still early stage. It's not coming up in a radiological exam. You're going to be doing testing after testing after testing after testing, right? So there's a cost equation that needs to be looked at. So one thing that we've been focusing on is that we should be focusing on cancer types where there is at least a prescriptive diagnostic journey, that you know the next step will be a PET scan. It's going to be a specific molecular test that you can do on a regular basis to know that there's an onset or there's a therapeutic intervention that can be done. So that's where that coming together of therapeutics, diagnostics, whether it's imaging or whether it's molecular diagnostics, comes together as an intersection to provide that end of that diagnostic odyssey for that patient so that the patient can get specific treatment. So that's the consideration that the governments will need to have.
Yes, I fully agree with you. It makes a lot of sense to me as well, most of all as a physician, because it wouldn't make sense to go and screen for glioblastoma. We know that even with surgery and everything, people die, like mortality, survival rates is 5% at 1 year or 2 years. Survival rates are very low, because there is no treatment. So it doesn't make sense to go and screen the population for glioblastomas, right? That's what you're saying. So it's good to focus on populations where there is a clear path to intervention.
Yeah, there must be a guideline of a pathway, right? There must be some specific guideline that, hey, this is what you do next. This is, if there is an early onset of the disease, this is a specific treatment that could be prescribed to the patient.
As a member of the Singapore's National Health Innovation Center Oversight Committee, what emerging healthcare technologies or trends excite you most today?
I see that there's a lot of different technologies that are in the pipeline right now. There's a big adoption of AI-based technologies in healthcare, right? And that's becoming transformative in terms of decision support, in terms of even getting towards digital therapeutics. But some of that has certain challenges as well that I foresee. I recently put up an article on this because I was deeply concerned. FDA has approved in the last couple of years, I think, close about 530 odd AI-based medical devices. So out of that 500 odd approvals for AI-based medical devices, only 200 of them, or less than half, so 40% of them have clinical validation. And so,
wow,
majority of them don't have any clinical validation. They are they are based on phantom data that has been put together. It's not been done in a real world setting. They have algorithms that have been approved based on their own generated data or their own generated computer image, and they are basically providing decision support. Yes, the threshold is low because they are not making a treatment decision or they are not making a specific therapeutic intervention. They are providing support to the doctor. So the doctor still needs to make the decision. But can you imagine if the doctor is getting ill advice and there's no validation to many of these devices? 43% are only clinically validated. Out of the 43%, only 22 of them have done randomized clinical control trials. So randomized clinical trials have not been done for majority of these interventions. People will argue that, okay, majority of them are 510K. They're not de novo or they're not a PMA submission. And so hence the threshold is much lesser. So, you know, why are you belittling this fact? Or why are you trying to push them to do clinical trials when they don't have to? But the point is there is a new technology and you don't know how it's going to be working in a real world setting. We are seeing hallucinations occurring in AI models everywhere. What makes you think that it's not happening in healthcare?
Yeah, that's true.
So I found that very, very unsettling. And I think this is, you know, you don't have the same threshold when it comes to diagnostics. You don't have the same threshold when it comes to medical devices. You don't have the same threshold when it comes to pharmaceuticals. So why are we making an exception when it comes to AI-based devices? So this is my question now, right? So I've been looking at this. But we are seeing a trend on AI. We are seeing a trend in robotics. We are seeing now an increased focus in terms of diagnostics and across different types of diagnostics. So not only oncology, you're seeing cardiology, biomarkers there. You're looking at specific genomic markers that are there in cardiology. And you are now also seeing the full-blown therapeutics, right? I think GLP drugs have changed the entire spectrum of therapeutics, and you're seeing a much broader resurgence of new therapeutics as well. So those are the things that I've seen in NHIC. But on the AI side, that's where I'm a little bit concerned. I feel that there must be enough rigor in that approval process that we have seen, and it has worked for us for all other types of devices or therapeutics.
Yes. Do you see any potential synergies between machine learning AI and your diagnostics area in terms of enhancements, in terms of acceleration, in terms of anything that you see fit for these two technologies to come together?
It's already happening, Mehdi. Our entire algorithm at the back end is all based on machine learning and AI, right? We basically have 3.2 billion permutations of genomic alterations that can occur. And the only way we are able to detect that with higher sensitivity and specificity is based on our callers that we have put, our algorithms that we put, our bioinformatics that we have put at the back end. So and that gets as more robust as we see more of those specific mutations and alterations. We get more sensitive, we get more able to pick up those particular alterations. It happens more in fusions. It's one area that becomes more robust as the technology becomes used more widely. Right, so we're already seeing it and it's already integrated into our workflow. We're also seeing the ability to use it in specific biomarkers and pathology. Right, so now, for example, PD-L1 testing has to be done separately from genomics, right, because it's a protein-based test. So you are able to now look at PD-L1 testing using algorithms and you are able to use specific imaging modalities to be able to detect that. You're able to look at HER2 testing using imaging as well. So it is one that will help and come together. It's sort of intersections are already occurring.
And in terms of collaboration, because you know LLMs and large language models and the backbone of machine learning and AI, etc., you know, all these models and all this data comes from somewhere. So what is your view on, let's say, open collaboration between your lab and other labs, and how do you see this crossbreeding happening, or do you still see it as a, you know, this is my IP, this is your IP? How do you see the cross collaboration in terms of open innovation happening in your particular area?
I think it's still going to be a little bit difficult because a lot of the technology and IP sits and overlaps with the data sets that we have as well, right? Because of the fact that we have that data sets, we are able to look at longitudinal monitoring of the disease. For example, we have the largest number of longitudinal tests done on individuals. So you are now able to look at disease epidemiology, and you are able to see how the cancer progresses, what are the resistance mechanisms, which are the alterations that are occurring, how do you are able to detect them much more effectively, how can you look as them as a prognosis, can you create certain interpretation for the doctors. So those are IP that will be very difficult to then start sharing widely, right? Because become ubiquitous. But I think where there could be real value add of coming together is there are a lot of post-population level studies that have been done, genomic studies that are being done globally, right? So you have the 100K NHS study genomic project. You have similarly 100 in the Middle East that was done in the Emirati population. You have it in Singapore. Yeah. And if all of those databases become open up and there is that sharing of their data sets, then you have actually population sets across different ethnicities, different backgrounds. You are then open that up to companies to look at and be able to create better products or better sensitivities across. I think that's where the collaboration becomes more meaningful.
Yeah, that's what I meant by large language models or large data sets that can be crossbred or help different pharmaceutics, diagnostic setting, do their own work streams by leveraging the same data set that is actually ubiquitous. That's great. Simran, what would be your 2 or 3 takeaways or recommendations, do's and don'ts? What failures have you learned from?
Well, I've been able to look at now is that, you know, we very quickly went into 40-odd markets. We went into different countries in Asia. One fallacy would be that the same model works in every single country. That never works. There's no one size fits all approach. So if you're thinking about that one size fits all approach, you're not going to be successful at all. You have to be thinking about the idiosyncrasies of a particular market. You need to understand what localization needs to happen. You need to understand what really is the burden of disease in that particular country and how are the different stakeholders operating and what level of influence they do there. Because it's different. Every market is different. So that's one learning that I've gained, right? Where I've seen firsthand that taking one singular approach is not going to be one that gives you success. I think the second one is also to be able to pivot very quickly. You know that there are going to be different opportunities at different points in time, and you can't be firstly doing everything at one time. So you need to prioritize. But if things are not going to plan, you must also be, I always tell my team, I have strong views, but they are loosely held. And so if we are
it's a good one.
If we are seeing that things are not getting traction and you know that it is not working in that particular market, it might be timing is not right, it might not be the right market, we have not the right go-to-market strategy, different things could be in play, right? You must be able to pivot and change very quickly and adapt to. If you are going to just stick it on and not be able to be inflexible, chances of success, at least in Asia, very limited.
Well, it takes a mature leader like you to do that. And believe me, you know, there aren't many. And to be able to navigate the uncertainties and pivot accordingly, it takes a lot of maturity.
I think the last one that has been a recipe of success, make sure you have people that are smarter than you.
Absolutely. I fully agree with you. If you're the smartest one in the room, you're in the wrong room, right?
Exactly. So that's the recipe for disaster.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Simran, for being with me today. Really appreciate your time. And I hope to see you soon in Singapore.
Looking forward to it, Maddie.
This has been Health Tech Central. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast channel and give us a rating or review. Finally, you can check out our news on healthtechcentral.io and inspire us with your feedback. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next exciting episode of Health Tech Central.